طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it every week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm, and we continue it in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Journalists are vulnerable to the wielders of power, particularly those journalists who are critical of them. We have all known critical journalists, in particular in times of war, face retribution from the criticized powers. The devastating number of journalists killed in Gaza during this war is astronomical. And because Israel will not allow the foreign press into Gaza, most of those who suffer are Palestinian. But there are also some journalists beyond the war front, even in Israel, who are sharply critical of the occupation of Palestine, the apartheid state that it has created, the genocidal war it is conducting. They also pay a price for their critical reporting and commentary. And today we feature one of them, Gideon Levy, who was a sharp critic of Israel and a strong truth teller who dares to reveal the Palestinian story in the Israeli news service, Haaretz. At times, the paper has had to provide bodyguards for Gideon, because of the pushback to his reporting, not only from the government, but also from his fellow citizens who happen to disagree with him. But he keeps on writing and speaking out, as you will now hear on the Brazilian talk show Agenda Mundo with host Ruben Rosenthal.
Hi, everyone. Today, Brazilian talk show Agenda Mundo welcomes Gideon Levy, journalist and commentator of Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Shalom, Gideon.
Shalom, I'm delighted. Shalom, Brazil.
I'm delighted and honored you have accepted our invitation. I must say, you are very, very courageous for speaking out against the tide in Israel, mainly when insanity seems to have overcome reason from most Israelis. Well, I'd like to start asking one or two personal questions, if you don't mind.
Sure, sure.
Okay. You were born in Israel, but your family came from old Czechoslovakia. Could you tell us about their struggle to escape from the Nazis until they finally arrived in Palestine?
Yeah. Both my parents were refugees, and that's very important to say so. They were not Zionists. They came to Israel because they had to look for a rescue place. They would have never left Europe without if it wouldn't be the Holocaust. And this must be also mentioned. They came separately. They didn't know each other. My father was 26 years old with a PhD in law. And he went on an illegal boat of refugees. There were 600 refugees on this boat. They were 5 months in the Mediterranean. No port would accept them. And the Brits prevented them from getting to Palestine. And they were sent to a detention center in Beirut, Lebanon. How did they live 5 months, 600 people? I have no clue. But there is no one to ask anymore. In any case, he arrived here illegally at night. They just smuggled into Palestine. And all the rest is history. My mother was 10 years younger. She was 16 then, and she was sent with a project of rescuing children, Aliyat HaNoar, the immigration of the youth, and she was sent to a kibbutz alone. She left her parents and brother back home. And also, you know, to be 16 and to be sent to a new country, you don't speak the language, you know nothing about it. So both of them were refugees.
Well, you have been a strong critic of the long-time abuse Palestinians have been submitted in the occupied territories and inside Israel itself, well before present Gaza war. You have a weekly column at Haaretz named Twilight Zone, where it denounced the constant oppression suffered by Palestinians. Gideon, during all this time, have you felt any sort of harassment when going out to places in Israel or in some other ways, like receiving ugly phone calls or in the internet?
You should ask if I ever felt that this is not happening. This is the routine of my life, but I don't think that I'm a victim. There were even times in 2014 in the former Operation Gaza where my newspaper had to hire me bodyguards. Now I feel much safer in the streets, but the social media is full with garbage and it's not always very pleasant, but I live with it.
Can imagine. Really can imagine. Well, some articles from Haaretz journalists say that there are neo-Nazi ministers in the Netanyahu government. Could you comment on that?
Look, some of the right-wing ministers in our government are by far more nationalistic, more racist, and more radical right than your Bolsonaro, than the right-wingers in Europe, which are called neo-Nazis. Their idea is very obvious. They are waiting for the good timing to transfer all the Palestinians from here. They are waiting to the opportunity for ethnic cleansing, and they don't hide it. They believe that the Jews have supremacy here and the Palestinians will never get any rights here. That's their thoughts. This can be defined only as neo-Nazis. What else can you call it?
Really? Well, Israeli NGO B'Tselem, Human Rights Watch, and Amnesty International published long reports denouncing that Palestinians are submitted to an apartheid system. The International Court of Justice is now analyzing 6 decades of Israeli oppression of Palestinians on top of the accusations of genocide put forward by South Africa. Just as a reminder to our audience, apartheid was the name originally used to characterize the racist regime led by white minority in South Africa before it was dismantled due to international pressure, and then Nelson Mandela became president. Gideon, could explain why the term apartheid can be applied to Israel, both at the West Bank and East Jerusalem? And what could you say about Palestinians who have the right to live in Israel? Are they second-class citizens? And how much things got worse from 2018 with the State of the Nation law approved by the Netanyahu government?
So, if it is apartheid or not, it's not a question of political opinion. It's a factual question. And anyone who has doubts is invited to go to the West Bank. And in the West Bank, what will you see? You will see 2 villages, one next to the other. One village gains all the resources, water, electricity, land, almost in an unlimited way. The inhabitants of this village have all the civil rights you can imagine yourself. They can participate, obviously, in the elections to the Israeli parliament. They have Israeli passports, they have freedom of movement, freedom of speech, and they live in democracy. The village just next by to them, many times it's a few hundred meters between the villages. The people there, Palestinians, who are, by the way, much longer there, many more generations in this village, on this land, they have very limited resources in terms of water, electricity. Many times they have none. They have very little land. Most of their land was confiscated by the settlement which is next to them. And above all, they have no civil rights, nothing. They are one of the few peoples in the world who don't have any citizenship. They are not citizens of any country in the world. They have no rights, not freedom of movement. The beach, for example, of Tel Aviv is like half an hour away from their homes, can never get there. They are locked in a reality under the wall, the separation wall. And all this division is because of ethnic identity. In one village, they are Jews and they have everything. In the next village, they are Palestinians and they have nothing. How else can you call it but apartheid? And it's time to realize it. Now, Israel claims it's the only democracy in the Middle East. That's very nice to hear. But you cannot be a democracy with having an apartheid system in your backyard. The West Bank is part of Israel in many ways. It's under the control of Israel for 55 years. So how dare you to call yourself a democracy when this reality is taking place in your backyard? There are another kind of Palestinians that you refer to, and those are the Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, those who live within the 67 border. They are 20% of the population, and they have basic civil rights, like in a democracy. They have passports, they have the right to vote and to be elected to the Israeli parliament. They have freedom of movement, freedom of speech, but much more limited than Jews, especially like now in times of war. But they are deeply discriminated in any field of life, from budgets to the legal system, from opportunities, working places. For example, Israel is now 75 years old, 76 years old. There was never established a new Palestinian town or village in all those years. While in Israel, there were so many new villages and towns. So I wouldn't call this an apartheid. That's a very discriminating regime within Israel. And obviously the law of nation, the nation law that you referred to, made things also official. What was before just practical facts on the ground, the law of nation, the nation law, made it also official. Israel declared itself as a country, as a society with Jewish supremacy.
Right. Some people believe that the situation is not all that bad for Palestinians who are Israeli citizens. So yeah, here in Brazil, I heard several times people say, oh, they had the same rights. They don't, really.
No, not. And it's always the question to compare it to whom. Yes, the situation is better than the people in Gaza and the West Bank. No, the situation is much worse relative to the Jews in Israel. And in a democracy, they should have been totally equal to the Jews, to the Jewish citizens in Israel.
Right. Some people believe that Netanyahu is responsible for all sins committed by Israel. But in case Netanyahu is forced to resign or is ousted from power at an early election, what could change for Palestinians? Could you also tell us about the role the Zionist left had in the past in the denial of a Palestinian homeland?
First of all, I'll answer your question with one word. Nothing. Nothing will change for the Palestinians if Netanyahu will not be a prime minister and there will be a prime minister from the central left. That's the only option. It can be either from the right or from the Zionist left. For the Palestinians, it will mean nothing. How do I know it? I know it because the Zionist left put all the foundations for the settlement project, for the occupation project. It all started not with Netanyahu. It all started with labor. They put the foundations. Netanyahu just brought it to more extreme places. But the Zionist left was never in favor of putting an end to the occupation, did never anything for a creation of a Palestinian state. So expectations should be very low. There will be certain things which will be different, but not for the Palestinians.
During the apartheid regime in South Africa, Nelson Mandela was kept incarcerated for 27 years for defending armed struggle to liberate black people. During the 80s, there were widespread campaigns in the West to free Mandela and end apartheid. Israel is keeping Marwan Barghouti in life imprisonment. He's a Palestinian politician leader who defended armed struggle to achieve Palestinian self-determination. Hamas is trying to include his name in the list of prisoners to be released by Israel in exchange for the hostages. But years ago, at another negotiation, Israel refused to free Barghouti, who has already been in prison for 20 years. Then I ask you, Guido, why so? And why you don't hear more about Barghouti in the press? After all, he's a very important Palestinian leadership.
Barghouti is also a personal friend of mine. You can't see it, but his photo is next to me in my room from a trip abroad we did many years ago together. And I think that Barghouti is not released exactly because he had the potential to unite the Palestinian people and to lead the Palestinian people and to create a real viable partner for peace. But Israel always said no to him, even before he went to prison. I remember years in which he went from one headquarter to the other of the Israeli Zionist parties and begged them, let's do something before everything will explode. And nobody would listen to him. And then he went to a new way, which was a way of what Israel calls terror and they call resistance. And he got 5 life sentences. And Israel is putting him in jail for so many years, knowing that he can be the only one right now who could make a change. But Israel doesn't want any change.
But why in the West there is not a movement to free him like there was with Mandela?
First of all, he's not a Mandela. I love him, I like him, I appreciate him, but Mandela you have once in a generation. He's not a Mandela. He is a fighter. He's a very, very devoted man for his people, but he's not a Mandela. Why the West? Why does the West, you are asking only about Barghouti? Why does the West put sanctions on Russia few weeks after Russia invaded Crimea and never thought to put sanctions on Israel after 55 years of occupation? Why? Because Israel is the darling of the West. We have to remember this.
Well, if the West is serious about the two-state solution, then it should be interested to release him from prison.
I agree.
And is he kept incommunicado?
Yes, and nobody can see him. I mean, I tried many times to meet him, but it's his wife sees him once in 2 weeks. But he's now he's in isolation. And you wouldn't like to be in an Israeli prison, especially after the war started, as a Palestinian prisoner.
Here in Brazil, the main Jewish institution, CONIB, became a sort of watchdog against Israel and Zionist critics, accusing them of anti-Semitism. CONIB is also trying to suppress voices of dissent in the Jewish community. It is presently taking legal action against an outspoken journalist of Jewish origin, Mr. Breno Altman. Guido, to which extent lawsuits are also happening in Israel together with censorship in the traditional and social medias against those that denounce genocide being committed in Gaza.
Israel launched a strategy a few years ago, which is extremely effective all over the world, together with the Jewish and Zionistic establishment all over the world and the Jewish communities, namely to label any criticism about Israel as anti-Semitism. And this paralyzed the world, mainly Europe. It is so effective that some countries even have laws which don't allow to criticize Israel, which don't allow to call for boycotts. Legally, I mean, they criminalized a conscious struggle, a struggle over justice. In many countries, they criminalized it. And what you describe here about the Jewish community in Brazil is true about the establishment of all the Jewish communities in the world, with one exception, which is very encouraging now, and that's the young generation of the Jewish community in the United States. There comes the change, the big change. I hope it will come also in your country, in Brazil. The young generation today of the Jewish community, not all of them obviously, but the majority says enough is enough. Now you must understand, once the Jewish establishment identifies itself automatically and blindly with Israel, it opens a window for anti-Semitism, because if you are part of the occupation, of the mass killing in Gaza, if you identify with it all along, so you might also pay a price for it publicly. So it's not only about supporting Israel, which is legitimate. But the problem is that the Jewish community support Israel blindly and automatically, and by this they identify themselves with the most right-wing circles in Israel. And that's very, very, very sad, because that's not friendship, by the way. If they think they are friends of Israel, I have news for them. This friendship corrupts Israel. That it's not a friendship. Friendship is to also criticize when it's needed. That's real friendship. But as I say, there is a source of hope in the young generation, first in the United States, in the progressive circles of the Democratic Party, and I hope it will get also to your country and all over the world.
Right. It's about this member of parliament that can be expelled. Talk about censorship again. He spoke against the war in Gaza, was it?
And then he can...
Isn't there a member of parliament that can be expelled from the Knesset?
Yeah. Sure. There is one member of parliament. There was never a case that a member of parliament was expelled from the parliament. Thanks God they didn't get the majority they needed, and it was rejected.
Right. In a recent opinion article, you have expressed a strong concern about the full horror that would happen if Israeli troops enter Rafah in Gaza. Biden said that a ground invasion could only occur if some conditions are fulfilled. Is it possible that Netanyahu is in fact bluffing about a ground invasion? Is he gambling to get the release of the hostages, to placate protests from the families, and at the same time force an evacuation of Palestinians from Gaza to Egypt? Is it a question of who blinks first?
No, it's not a question of who blinks first. It's a question of the priorities of Israel. And you have to choose either releasing the hostages as first priority or continuing the war and trying to crush Hamas, which will never happen, as first priority. And this government was very clear. They prefer continuing the war and crushing Hamas over releasing the hostages, even at any price. I thought, and many Israelis think, that the hostages are the main goal now, and they should be released at any price, because their time is running out. There are elderly people there, there are children, there are women. They will not survive. But the government thinks differently. Now, as about Rafah, if Israel gets into Rafah, there will be a humanitarian catastrophe that even in Gaza we didn't see it. Because in Gaza, Israel pushed all the Gaza Strip into Rafah. There are over 1.5 million people trying to find shelter there. Where will they go? To the sea? Where will they go? To the sky? And where will be the resources? You know, it's 1.5 million people. What about food? What about water? What about electricity? Nothing. So if Israel will continue, it will just increase those who claim that Israel has an intention of genocide.
But do you believe that he will go against the what Biden has recommended in this case?
Yes, as long as Biden just talks, yes. If Biden will take measures, then there will be different scenes. But until now, Biden was just talking, and Israel learned to ignore recommendation of an American president because it's never followed by actions.
I hope there'll be a first time.
So do I.
Well, the Biden administration has imposed sanctions on four violent settlers from the occupied West Bank, followed by United Kingdom and Spain. It seems that Israeli banks closed the accounts of these settlers as to avoid to be themselves targets of sanctions. But how effective such measures can be if extremists in the government like Ministers Smotrich and Ben-Gvir are not themselves the main targets of the sanctions?
Look, you understand by yourself that to put sanctions on four individuals is a joke. And you might think it's a beginning of something. Okay, but let's see how it continues. I am not impressed by putting sanctions on four individuals. It's ridiculous. Those people, in any case, don't travel to the United States and don't have any business in the United States. It's a joke. It's too little, it's too late, it's ridiculous.
Well, the war in Gaza brought again the urgency of finding a solution for Palestinian self-determination. But as things are now, Israel will not accept either a two-state solution or a democratic one-state, I mean a state with equal rights for all citizens. You have already defended the sanctions, that sanctions are imposed against Israel, the so-called BDS, boycott, disinvestment, and sanctions, as the only way to force Israel to accept Palestinian self-determination. Do you believe that the BDS can be imposed on Israel if the West are not part of the efforts? Do you see a role that Global South could have to boost the BDS campaign?
Absolutely. I think the BDS campaign is right now the only game in town. As long as governments don't even consider putting sanctions over Israel, so it's only for the civil societies to do so. And civil societies are important everywhere. And civil societies might influence their governments. And there is now a momentum of really critical voices getting against Israel. It's not a joke what's happening now, and there is a very positive momentum, in my view, to recruit more resistance to the occupation, more resistance to the war in Gaza, in public opinions. And in this point of view, every country counts, every society counts, because finally, it should become the whole world calling Israel, not only with words, this the world did in endless resolutions in the UN, but also in deeds, telling Israel that enough is enough.
Right. Well, the United Nations and the heads of state from several countries defend the so-called two-state solution based in the pre 1967 borders. But you and some important analysts say that it would be impossible to remove 500,000 Israeli settlers from the West Bank plus another 200,000 from East Jerusalem. Both solutions are very difficult to implement. Only troops from the United States could do that, I suppose. There is also a proposal of a confederation of two nations, the so-called Holy Land Confederation. Yossi Beilin from Israel and Palestinian Hiba Hussein put forward this proposal. I have no idea how representative they are. In short, it is based on exchange of land as to allow Jewish settlers to stay where they are in the West Bank. So, Guido, my question is whether such proposal could be a better way to move forward and solve the Palestinian question when the present crisis in Gaza is over and the extreme right is out of power, and eventually when there is a lot of pressure from international pressure on Israel. Is that a better solution to start the confederation of two nations?
Look, the two-state solution is a very just solution. Two peoples struggle over one piece of land. Let's divide the land. It makes sense. And by the way, the two peoples are right now equal in their size. 7.5 million Palestinians, 7.5 million Jews between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean, including Gaza. The only problem is that there is no place anymore, no room, physical room for a viable Palestinian state. As you rightly mentioned, with 700,000 settlers, there is no room for a viable Palestinian state, and nobody is going to evacuate those 700,000 settlers. Part of them are very violent people. All of them are a very powerful group in Israeli politics. And I don't see them being evacuated. Without their evacuation, there is no Palestinian state. They might be a Bantustan, like in South Africa, but not a state. For sure not an equal state. And therefore, I think we should stop talking about the two-state solution, realizing that this train left the station, and start to think about new ideas. And the only alternative idea is the one-state solution. Namely, one state between the river and the sea with equal rights to everybody. One person, one vote. That's the only remaining solution. It will take a lot of time to adjust to it. There will be endless obstacles, but at least it is a vision. A real democracy. Not an apartheid democracy, but a real democracy. And we should start somewhere, because continuing to talk about the two-state solution plays to the hands of the occupation.
Well, let's go to the north of Israel now. There are now four divisions of the Israeli army at the north border. How do you see the situation there?
It's a very, very, very explosive situation. And I can just say I hope it will be solved through a diplomatic agreement, because if there will be war also with the North, this will be a new game, a game changer in terms of casualties, in terms of killing, in terms of also danger to turn into a regional war. And the regional war can very easily turn into a world war. So we are really playing here with explosives, and I hope the first stage should be finishing the war in Gaza today. If the war in Gaza will be over, Hezbollah declared, they will stop shooting at Israel.
Well, but what about the question of the Sheba farms?
Don't take me there, because I'm really not an expert for this. And those things are really technical things. Israel should get into diplomatic negotiation with Lebanon and decide about all those technical questions. We leave it for diplomats.
I suppose that concerning the Golan Heights, Israel is going never to leave the Golan Heights?
Never say never. Never say never. We were very close, much closer than returning the West Bank. Don't forget that the Golan Heights is still empty from Jews. There are only a few thousand Jews living there. So it is possible. But you know, Syria is right now not a place that you can make peace with, but this can easier change rather than the West Bank and Gaza.
Was it not strategic for Israel to implement settlements there in Golan Heights?
They just failed. It didn't work. They failed. The religious Jews don't see it as holy as the West Bank. So the religious didn't go there. And for the seculars, it was too far away.
I see. Gideon, we have already talked a lot about a lot of subjects. Well, before we finish, is there something else you'd like to add? Maybe yes. You could let, and also maybe you could let know about the main headlines in Haaretz this week.
No,
but please be free to talk anything else you'd like more.
No, not the main headline, but I would like to raise one more question, and that's your adorable president, Lula. We cannot talk this whole conversation without mentioning Lula. And my problem is that Israel found itself in the last years under Netanyahu, friends of all the extreme right-winger populist leaders, from Bolsonaro to Orban, from Orban to Donald Trump, obviously, all over the world, the president of the Philippines, all kinds of weirdos. And Lula, I'm not an expert for Brazil, obviously, but I have no doubts that he's a man of conscience. I have no doubts about it. Also, his whole career was, and you might disagree, but that's my feeling toward Lula. I was sorry that he involved the Holocaust. I think it's counterproductive to compare to the Holocaust, because it's very easy to prove that what Israel is doing is not a Holocaust, and then everything is wonderful. If it's not a Holocaust, so bravo Israel. That's not the case. Israel is doing horrible things, and they are not a Holocaust. And still, I was ashamed in the way that Israel treated your ambassador in Tel Aviv, a new ambassador. All this really cheap humiliation to bring him to Yad Vashem. And really, it was annoying. And I really hope for better days, because Lula should be Israel's friend and not Bolsonaro, if I may say so.
Well, I fully agree what you have said. I believe that Lula was a little bit unhappy with his words. He could have criticized the killings, the massacres, the genocide, but you cannot compare Holocaust.
Exactly.
There have been others that happened in this century, and each one has its own history, characteristics. It's not reason to compare the sufferings and from different people. Right?
Absolutely.
Right. Is there any message you'd like to send to him, to Lula?
No.
Right. So, Guido, thank you again for coming to the show and
My
present
pleasure.
Your views, right? And I'm sure it has been most appreciated by our viewers, and I ask our audience to spread the link of today's program and give the likes. And something I'd like to say is that I like very much your articles. A great fan from Yuri Avery.
I thought so.
Avery, right?
He was my teacher. He was my idol.
Right. I think he's missed a lot, right? His strengths and all that.
Absolutely.
Gush Shalom, the group, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right. All right. Thank you very much, then, Guido.
Thank you very much. All the best. All the best.
All the best for you as well.
You have been listening to an interview with the intrepid journalist Gideon Levy, who courageously writes for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. If you want to sleep a little later on Sunday morning and want to hear the program later in the day, or at any other time of the week, via the instant archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive, go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. However, each program is temporarily on this archive for only 2 weeks. You can also online stream This Week in Palestine live every Friday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on KKRN.org, a community radio station in Round Mountain, California. You can find all our past broadcasts on our permanent archive at truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org. Then click on This Week in Palestine Archives. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.